It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
At the center, an unapologetically incendiary president.
Our national political culture is motivating folks who are inspired by hate, by fear, by bigotry.
It's hard not to look at it and see that it is connected. We've seen this rise in sort of a hot political rhetoric.
And I think this president's whole modus operandi is to divide us.
Not letting the Republican Party off the hook. They are the beneficiaries of racism in America, right?
So there you go, Sandy Rios with you. We have 11 people who have been killed and at least 6 more wounded in the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh on Saturday morning, and that is the way the media portrays it. It must be Donald Trump's fault. Sandy Rios with you here on Monday. It's Robert Bowers who pulled the trigger. He was an anti-Semite. People have looked at his, it's not hidden. He hates the Jews. He shouted it when he shot them that he wanted to kill them all. And so we know that Robert Bowers also was not a Trump supporter. He said that on his social media, did not vote for him, did not support him. And yet the whole narrative continues that somehow President Trump is anti-Semitic, even though his son-in-law is Jewish. His daughter is a Jewish convert. He has many, many contacts and supporters in the Jewish community. But, of course, the truth does not have to really be, it doesn't have to be truth. What the left says in the media does not have to be true. David Lee Miller had an update this morning on the shooting. Let's listen.
Good morning from the Squirrel Hill neighborhood. Behind me, the Tree of Life Synagogue. It is still a crime scene. You can see that there is still police tape set up along the perimeter. On Saturday morning, authorities say 46-year-old Robert Bowers killed 11 people here. He entered the building with 3 handguns and an AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle. They say he used all 4 weapons in his rampage. An FBI affidavit quotes him as saying, during the rampage, they are committing genocide to my people. I just want to kill Jews. The U.S. attorney has now indicated that he has started the process to seek the death penalty. Meanwhile, for the first time now, survivors are speaking out. Barry Werber was only feet away from the gunman inside the synagogue, but he miraculously went unnoticed.
He didn't see us. Thank God. The only thing I had in my hand was a cell phone, and it's a dumb phone, so it doesn't light up when I'm talking on it. I could see that he looked around only because there was a shaft of light as he opened the door. He stepped over Mel's body, didn't pay any attention, stepped back and walked out.
At last word, authorities said the gunman Bowers was being treated for injuries he sustained in his shootout with police at a local hospital. He's reported in fair condition. And later today, guys, he will have his initial court appearance here in Pittsburgh.
Okay, David Lee Miller on Fox, as Sandy Rios back with you. Now, this is the kind of nonsense that goes on after this. There are accusations now that it's the Jews' fault. Those that supported Donald Trump moving the embassy to Jerusalem, it's their fault. It's the fault of the police. It's the fault of President Trump. And on it goes. The madness. I would say the common denominator here is that wickedness is increasing. That the sacredness of life long was lost here. I think most of us still hold it, thank God. But the wicked are feeling somehow unrestrained. And the Jewish people, our Jewish brethren, of course, are... Look, a lot of churches have been shot up. We do know that. There have been terrible shootings. The Charleston church comes to mind a year and a half ago or so. But the Jew, our fellow travelers, the Jewish population, of course, fresh from the Holocaust. It's still fresh on their minds. And anti-Semitism has been rising in Europe. It's rising on college campuses, and it's rising in America, too. And America has been their refuge. And we already know what attack Israel is under, that tiny little country. in the middle of the Middle East. And so they feel it. They feel afraid, as you can understand. It's like a fresh wound for them. Christians are still, we still kind of fancy ourselves the majority. And I don't think we feel feelings. Look, feelings and emotions have nothing to do with reality. I'm not stating reality here. I'm talking about feelings. And so Christians don't have that imminent threat feel yet that our Jewish brethren have. But it was a tragedy, and it is a tragedy, and we have to fight having our country move to this anti-Semitic embrace, especially among our kids on college campuses. Can you imagine? You know, they've been taught multiculturalism and diversity, but not for Jews. Isn't that something? You think about that. How irrational is that? But we'll come back to that on another day. Our friend, my friend, John, whose name I can't remember in this moment, has pointed out that the Tree of Life Synagogue was a gun-free zone, as are so many of the places where these shootings take place, whether they're movie theaters, restaurants. Trust me, the shooters notice when it's a gun-free zone, and those are the places that they pick. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. We'll talk about that maybe more on another day, too. And I think part of the problem is that so many Jews are so liberal. They're secular Jews, and even those that do worship and acknowledge God are very much to the left in terms of their political leanings. And they are not Second Amendment supporters. So they don't protect themselves. They don't protect their synagogues. And it's going to make them more of a target. We'll come back to that on another day. You might wonder what's happening with the pipe bomber. When we talked about it last week, a lot has been happening, but it's kind of fallen off the pages because the pipe bomber was arrested, and Cesar Sayoc was arrested, and so it's kind of gone quiet. And maybe that's good. I don't know. No one was killed. These devices, in spite of the FBI director's comments and statement in this press conference, from all reports that I have, they were not created to be able to detonate, and none of them did detonate. And of course, we know that the media jumped on that to compare the bombs mailed to 9/11, to blame President Trump. In fact, CNN in their chyron, you know, that's that the lettering that goes back and forth underneath the picture. This is one of the chyrons they ran. Manhunt for serial bomber going after Trump's targets. Going after Trump's targets, you see. And so the inference, of course, is that this is caused by President Trump once again and Trump supporters. And all of the targets were people that President Trump had criticized, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, you know, or Robert De Niro. You fill in the blanks. In fact, Wolf Blitzer said, the one common thread between all of these bombs, all of those who are being targeted are President Trump's frequent punching bags. And Brian Stetler said, and from CNN, said that the targets of the bombs were all criticized mercilessly by right-wing outlets. So naturally, it's our fault because we said bad things about these people, because we say bad things. It's our fault that somebody actually sent a bomb to them. Many of us are still not buying this story of Brian Sayoc, and I'm going to give you some information about this, Cesar Sayoc. I'm getting my names confused. Cesar, C-E-S-A-R Sayoc. This is from a listener, and I want to read what he has to say. This is Glenn. Glenn, by the way, was a very generous donor to our fall share-a-thon. So, Glenn, thank you so much for that. And this is what he says. Please, please introduce some sanity about these Hollywood show bombs. If a person actually wanted to blow someone up with a mail bomb, they would use a trigger that activated when the package was open. It is impossible to do it with a timer. If the desire is to blow up not oneself carrying the sorting center to the sorting center of origin, not the sorting center, not the big truck carrying bulk mail to another state, not the sorting center of destination, not the mail truck driver of destination, not the empty front porch of the targeted person, not the persons working for the targeted person who handle their mail, not the garbage dump or lake bottom where it is thrown after looking like a bomb, not the bomb squad after looking like a bomb, but a particular target. It is impossible to know what time to set it. In other words, the timer. You can't possibly set a timer not knowing all those variables. We don't even know what day the mail will arrive. The reason the fake bombs had timers is so that Americans who have no experience with real bombs but have seen Hollywood depictions ad nauseum would identify them as bombs. Look at the targets. Almost none are currently holding any political office. What do they glaringly have in common? They appeared in Democrat angry mob montages inciting violence and incivility against people with a different political viewpoint. The purpose of the show bombs is to portray the perpetrators as the victims. You know, thank you, Glennon. That's very well said. I couldn't say it any better. And I actually, that's my leaning too. I don't care what they say. Cesar Sayoc was he is, from all accounts, quite unhinged. But he is the perfect choice for someone to use to set up an incident like this. And I want to read something to you. Look, I could be wrong about this. Of course I could be wrong. But I'm just saying this doesn't sit well. This just seems odd. Does not seem odd to you that Cesar Sayoc has this beautiful brand new van? He doesn't have a job or hardly anyone. Pizza delivery, a strip club bodyguard. And he's living in his van, which is a brand new van, like with no nicks on it. Perfectly. And then the windows are perfectly on the windows are perfectly placed, all of these posters, and they have targets over the faces of some of the people that he sent bombs to. And inside, he's supposedly making these pipe bombs. Doesn't that seem strange and a little risky if you're doing that inside your van? And I thought that putting gun sights on the faces of people was long ago. Remember, they accused Sarah Palin of causing the shooting of Gabby Gifford because she put a target over the face of Gabby Gifford, which she was just showing targeted races. And they made a big deal out of that. So it's just those posters on Cesar Sayoc's van just fit perfectly, beautifully placed and perfectly propagandized driving around in Miami, where it might not be so popular to have a van like that, but it's nothing's harmed, nothing's scratched. I think that's suspicious. And so I want to share with you a piece that we're going to post on our Facebook by Shad Olson. Shad is a talk show host, I believe, in South Dakota. He's also a journalist. And he ended up pulling the Facebook of Cesar Sayoc before it was removed. And I want to read just a little bit of what Shad has to say. While the mainstream media quickly labels Cesar Sayoc as a bona fide Trump-loving conservative Republican, social media and internet investigation shows the alleged MAGA bomber listed as a registered Democrat since 1980, only changing to Republican in 2016, and reveals multiple social media posts hating Republicans and the GOP, bashing George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, posting photos of Bush and Cheney as war criminals, praising Code Pink, liberal women, and the beautiful women of the world. And that's only the beginning. He goes on and say he refers to the wrapped and plastered Trump paraphernalia as like a Trump tribute befitting a circus routine. And I think he's right about that. I don't think that's an over-the-top description of what we saw. Former male dancer, former professional soccer player, former male review coordinator, casino entertainment marketing and events promoter, and it goes on and on. Most recently working at the Seminole Hard Rock Casino in December 7th of 2006, Now, one thing that Shad goes into, because South Dakota would know about this, most of us don't, members of the Seminole tribe leadership have served as high-level and lucratively pocketed Democrat donors and political activists. While a spokesman for the Seminole tribe has issued a statement denying Cesar Altieri Sayoc ever worked for the tribe or was an employee for the casino, multiple pictures on his social media account show him at the Hard Rock Casino posing with employees, entertainment acts, and friends. His point is that the Seminole Nation, Hard Rock Casino, the whole Seminole Nation is not a Trump supporter. In fact, he goes on to the rivalry between the Trump casinos and the Seminole casinos. And so here is Cesar, who works for them, but they're claiming he doesn't work for them. Now, suddenly, this Trump supporter, and his allegation is that he was suddenly transformed. He says that on the pages that he found before it was scrubbed, I think, around noon on Friday. I believe that's what he says. We find that he was a registered Democrat. Now, I don't know Shad. I know people that know him, but I think this is interesting. We'll put this article on our Facebook page and you can read and share it. So there you go. Lots to say about the election. And we'll talk to Congressman Mark Meadows when we return. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
80% of the time, an abortion-minded mother who views an ultrasound or sonogram of her baby will choose life. Here's the story of Candace.
The sonogram sealed the deal for me. My baby was like this tiny little spectrum of hope. And I saw his heart beating on the screen. And knowing that there's life growing inside, I mean, that sonogram changed my life. I went from just Candace to mom. Thank you to everybody that has given these gifts. You guys are giving more than money. You guys are giving love.
There are currently preborn centers which do not have an ultrasound machine. Would you sponsor a machine today? Dial pound 250 and say keyword baby. That's pound 250 and say baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Your love can save a life.
Here's Dan Celia with today's Stewardship Moment.
Jesus tells us in Matthew 6:21 this, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." The great preacher Henry Ward Beecher once said, "No man can tell whether he is rich or poor by turning to his ledger. It is the heart that makes a man rich. He is rich according to what he is, not according to what he has." It is what we feel in our hearts as to what God's will is for us. It is our hearts that will clearly help us to understand the stewardship of our possessions.
You've just heard a Stewardship Moment with Dan Celia of Financial Issues Ministry, helping you plan, give, and invest wisely. For more information, log on to financialissues.org. That's financialissues.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Peter Koh, and I'm a business major, and this is my junior year at the college. What I love about the athletics here at Truett McConnell University is the coaches and their side of trying to teach sports from a biblical mindset with sportsmanship involved, and it really changes the way that you pursue the game, not just passionately doing it for other people, but also for yourself and to glorify God in that, which is completely different from most other schools.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
For as far back as anyone can remember, Austin High School in Texas had a homecoming court. The king was a boy and the queen was a girl. But that tradition has come to an end thanks to the high school's Gay-Straight Alliance. The controversy started when a lesbian couple decided to run for both king and queen. The school explained only boys were permitted to run for king, so the lesbian couple reached out to the media. And within a matter of a few minutes, the school had decided to completely eliminate the king and the queen position. The sex and gender revolutionaries conquered America's public school system many years ago. When we were that age, high school was about parsing participles and dissecting frogs. But these days, high school is about advancing a radical and, quite frankly, militant agenda to redefine what it means to be a boy and a girl. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Let's take a moment and remember those that lost their lives in Pittsburgh and express our gratitude for the law enforcement who responded so beautifully. A moment of silence.
Marsha Blackburn is a white supremacist!
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That happened yesterday at a Marsha Blackburn rally. Marsha, of course, is running for Senate in Tennessee against Phil Bredesen. And she was trying to have a moment of silence for all of the our Jewish friends killed in that Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh. And that's what happened. And they had to drag out, I think, seven protesters. You see how uncivil this is all becoming. My next guest knows a lot about this. Congressman Mark Meadows has been in Congress since 2013, and I think before that he was a very successful businessman, like having a life in North Carolina. First of all, welcome, Congressman Meadows. Welcome to the show.
Sandy, great to be with you as always, and certainly great to be with your listeners.
I want to ask you something personal, because before you ran for Congress in 2013, did you ever in a million years envision that you'd be taking on House leadership, which is what you have done, that you would be leading something like the Freedom Caucus, that you would be fighting enemies from without, trying to destroy the Republican president, and worse than that, some of the deep state, just the issues that you guys have taken on. Did you see any of that when you decided to run for Congress?
Well, no, I didn't. I mean, running for Congress was really never on my bucket list. Obviously, I had a concern for my country, like you do and like many of our listeners do. But the biggest part of it is making sure that we continue to fight for what is important to the American people. And really, it's about their voice and their values. And sadly, in D.C., sometimes the people that push back against that are our own party. And so when we created the Freedom Caucus, it was all about making sure that the millions of forgotten men and women that believe that Washington, D.C. had forgotten them would be remembered by a group of members. And so it's been an honor to serve, but it's one that I don't take lightly, and prayerfully ask for the prayer support of so many people across the country, and I feel it each and every day.
You know, if I didn't say this, Congressman Meadows is the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus. And Congressman, I have to say, whenever I hear people getting tired of this fight, average citizens or myself, I get weary. I remember 2016, I got really weary. And it's wearying now also. I think of you. I think of Congressman Jordan. And I know that I personally cannot quit, because you are on the front lines paying the price daily. You know, I hear it in your voice this morning, because I know this is a campaign cycle and you're interceding for a lot of people who are in some really tough races. I want to ask you, do you think that the things that people say are at stake in this midterm election are overstated or understated?
Well, if anything, I think they might be understated, Sandy. I mean, when we look at what is at stake, I mean, you had the lead in there with just here is a civil moment asking for a moment of silence for those that lost their life in a Jewish synagogue, and yet it's interrupted by protesters. And, you know, we would expect that kind of thing in a third world country, but we don't expect it here in the United States. And so whether it's the pro-life initiative, whether it's religious liberty, whether it is literally about a smaller government, and making sure that government is accountable, this election is critically important, and I can tell you, every vote matters. I'm all over the country right now trying to help different members of Congress that have a conservative worldview, and I can tell you that it is nip and tuck in some of the seats that you would think that we should be able to win easily. The other side is very motivated and very energized.
The Freedom Caucus is nonpartisan, is it not? I know that every member is a Republican, but principally you're not limiting it to Republicans, are you?
We are not. Actually, if there's someone willing to stand up, and we've had conversations many times with a number of other people in the other party that, you know, act like they're willing to stand up to the leadership and the special interest groups in Washington, D.C., you know, very rarely will it ever happen. And we're viewed as a conservative caucus, so I don't know that it would necessarily be a political winner for a Democrat to join us. But it really is not as much of a partisan issue as it is a principled issue. It's an issue of making sure that the person who gets here and actually gets sworn into office has their allegiance to the American people. It's a representative form of government. We take that seriously, and that means that you represent the interests of those people back home, regardless of the consequences, and that's what made us stand out. And sometimes we get headlines that are less than flattering, but when you go back home, people realize that you're fighting for them.
Yes, and I can attest to that, having a front row seat. And I want to talk first of all about some of the members of the Freedom Caucus who are in some tough races. I have a list of four, but you may know of more. I'm going to rattle them off, and then I'd love your comments about what you think's happening. Dave Brad in Virginia 7 is being challenged by Abigail Spanberger. Scott Perry in Pennsylvania, Ted Budd in North Carolina, and Rod Blum in Iowa. What can you tell us about those races?
Well, all four of those races are within the margin of error as we go into this final 10 days or 8 days, I guess, of early voting in my state. But we've got just about a little over a week left. And all four of those were in the margin of error. And you're right, those four individuals have been fighting really tooth and nail to make sure that your values and my values and the values of their voters are heard. And yet we're seeing millions of dollars. I've never seen this much money come in against those four individuals. Rod Blum probably has the toughest district in that he has a Democrat district that typically votes more Democrat than Republican. And yet they're in Dubuque, Iowa, which is I went up to visit. You find a very strong pro-life Catholic Democrat. And if they were going to vote on one issue, that would be the issue because, you know, his opponent is pro-abortion. He's 100% pro-life. And so he was down by double digits. Now we're basically tied in that race. And so it's trending our way. The others that you mentioned, Scott Perry has half of his district is a new district. And he is out, working parades and football games. And I've never seen anybody work as hard as Scott Perry, but he's in a real tough race. Then as you shift more to Virginia and North Carolina, Ted Budd, a new member, and we're recent polling has it trending in his way. Early voting has it trending in his way. So we're a little bit more optimistic there. But every vote counts. But the eyes are always on that one race, and really the race that you mentioned, Dave Bratz, has probably been the focus of the entire country. It's there in Virginia in the Richmond suburbs, and he is going against really a very liberal individual that has, I think, about $6 million spent on her behalf. And that is certainly very, very close. Dave Bratt, as you know, beat Eric Cantor. He has been a strong voice for reforms in Washington, D.C. And they would like nothing more than to pick up those four seats. But those are the four most critical seats that we have. And probably Dave Bratt's and Rod Blum's are the most troubling right now in terms of where the polling is.
You know, I want to add that with Congressman Bratt, he also has the ire of the Republican Party because of beating Eric Cantor. And so I don't know what kind of support the party apparatus is giving him, but if it follows the past pattern, it's not going to be much support. So he's really swinging out there. Virginia is very purple, and that's close to D.C., and you and I both know who travels down from D.C. to do their dirty work. Abigail Spanberger, by the way, taught in what was called Terror High, the Saudi Academy, and she has a lot of explaining to do about that, and that's not been made as much of in that campaign as it probably should have. I want to move ahead because you guys have a PAC, a Political Action Fund. It's House Freedom Fund, and you have identified, I'm counting, maybe eight, I'm guessing, 10 maybe, candidates around the country. I'm assuming that's where you've been campaigning, right?
Well, it is where we've been campaigning, Sandy. I can tell you the House Freedom Fund has because of the generosity of people across the country, has been able to consistently send money to what we say the five top incumbents that we're trying to defend, and you mentioned four of those, and then the top five challengers that will be potentially Freedom Caucus members. And the people have been so generous and candidly, that money, whether it comes in as $20 or $10 or $50 or $100, has made a huge difference in these races and allowed them to be in there. And we are I'm happy to say, competitive in all of those races that we've identified.
Okay, so House Freedom Fund, people ask a lot of times, ask me, they want to help, you know, and interestingly enough, a lot of them have contacted the Republican Party in their states, and they get no response. They want to volunteer, they want to give, they want to do, this is coming from various states, and so another option might be House Freedom Fund, where they help these strong conservative candidates. All right, Congressman, let's talk about who these candidates are. Can you just give us an idea here of who you're supporting?
In terms of some of the newer candidates that are running, we have Yvette Harrell out in New Mexico, too, and she is a strong conservative running in what would be considered a purple seat. She's actually polling up a little bit. She's doing it extremely well, and we've been very, very pleased with her efforts out there in a very tough district, and we're hopeful that she wins in just a few days there. You come to Texas, and we've got Chip Roy, who is not only a strong conservative, but someone with a backbone, willing to stand up even in the face of great adversity. And we think Chip will make a very good member of the Freedom Caucus as he comes in. Additionally, you come to North Carolina, the old Robert Pittenger seat. We have Mark Harris in a battle that really is outside of Charlotte. That race has just gotten to the point where not only has the president come in, but just about everybody on all sides. I know the Democrats are sending people in. And what's happened is a lot of times the Democrats are trying to recruit people that appear to be conservative and appear to be, you know, pro-gun, pro-military, pro-religious freedoms. And when you start to peel it back, they're really not that way. And so Mark Harris is running a very, very strong race. We believe that he'll be victorious here in a few days. We have a couple of other members that actually Greg Stubbe down in Florida that we believe will finish strong, and a number across the country. But as we look at these races, you know, the tightest ones in terms of challengers are probably Yvette Harrell in New Mexico, Chip Roy in Texas, and Mark Harris in North Carolina.
Are you saying that the others, because I see that you've got potential members are also Russ Fulcher in Idaho, Lena Epstein in Michigan, Ron Wright in Texas, Mark Green in Tennessee, Denver Riggleman in Virginia, and Ben Klein in Virginia. I don't know if you guys are supporting them, but okay. So are you saying,
and it's just those races. Actually, Lena Epstein in Michigan is in a real tight race in the margin of error, and she would be another one I would add to that category. Some of the others look, they're a little bit more probable in terms of their seats. They're on our radar that we support them, but it looks like they're going to have an easier time to victory is why I didn't highlight them.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so that was you actually answered the question I never got out, and that is, are you saying that you think they're going to win? So that's interesting. All right, so that's a kind of a list of those. Congressman, I would love to talk to you. I don't want to put you on the spot too much because I know how many hours you're putting in right now, but I would really love to talk to you about the leadership race coming up if you have a few more minutes after this break. Is that possible?
Sure, we will be glad to do it.
Okay, thank you. You're very kind. Congressman Mark Meadows, chairman of the Freedom Caucus, he has been such a champion for us in ways that you can't even imagine. And so he needs your prayers. I'm guessing you're in a safe seat, but not for victory in this race, but just because the stamina required to do the things he's tackling is amazing. While others who are more faint-hearted would have given up or gone back to their business, he has stayed the course. And we are at a crucial time. And people, men who have principle and want to fight for this country, need and deserve our support. We'll take a break and come right back and talk about the leadership races, because boy, is that interesting. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
And if the blind lead the blind, both will fall into a pit. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. In an interview with the far-left outfit Democracy Now!, Democrat candidate for New York's 14th District Congressional seat and soon-to-be Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez lamented the fact that people are disappointed when candidates like her don't have fully formed opinions or otherwise understand the issues they discuss publicly. She said this after being unable to articulate a cogent position on Middle East policy concerning Israel. It would almost be funny if she wasn't headed to Washington, D.C. to deliberate and vote on pretty important issues like the federal budget and stuff like that.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. As the invading army of illegal aliens continues to snake its way across Mexico, politicians are ransacking scripture to find some justification for taking care of them all. Perhaps the most feeble is to use the parable of the Good Samaritan, which Governor Kasich of Ohio does. The main problem here is that the parable is not addressed to government, it's addressed to you and me. The Good Samaritan didn't outsource compassion and generosity to the government. He dug into his own pocket and invested his own time to see to it that the victim's wounds were bandaged and he had a place to lodge while he recovered. The difference between conservatives and regressives is that regressives believe compassion is giving away other people's money, while we as conservatives believe compassion is giving away our own money.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Dan Celia from Financial Issues.
You know, we look at the volatility in the markets right now, or the lack of anything in the markets. And this is a great time to take a pause, rethink all of our portfolio, look at our asset allocation model. Are we following the asset allocation model as it should be? Are we overweighted one place or another? You know, I've been an advocate for biblically responsible investing for many, many years. I've been an advocate for charitable gift annuity because I'm an advocate for permanent income. Call the AFA Foundation to start talking about it.
A knowledgeable AFA Foundation representative will gladly explain the nuances of charitable gift annuities and answer your questions. Find out about charitable gift annuities when you call 800-326-4543, extension 345. 800-326-4543, extension 345. Or by visiting afafoundation.net.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. I grew up near the Pittsburgh synagogue that was murderously attacked on Saturday. The 11 elderly people killed there were neighbors in a community I remember fondly for its tranquility and harmony. Another vivid memory is that some 5 decades ago, this house of worship was one of those that prominently displayed a sign exhorting congregants and passersby like me to save Soviet Jews. That expression of concern for others is a hallmark of so many of the Jewish faith. It launched a movement that ultimately liberated millions of Jews and hundreds of millions of others enslaved by the evil empire. Sadly, Jews now need saving in lots of places, including in Europe and even in America, where anti-Semitic violence is on the rise. We must stand against those who would come for them and then for the rest of us. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I worry about tribal identity politics becoming the new norm of how politics is waged. As conservatives, we always thought this was sort of a left-wing Linsky thing. Unfortunately, the right practices identity politics now as well. It's the day and age, it's technology and everything else. Identity politics, which is now being practiced on both sides of the aisle, is unfortunately working. And I think we, as leaders, we got to figure out how do we make inclusive aspirational politics strategically valuable again.
That was the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, in an interview over the weekend. And, of course, he compares, he says in that interview that the right also is embracing Saul Alinsky principles, which I found particularly offensive given Saul Alinsky's abrasive mob-like, taken from the mob of Chicago principles. Sandy Rios back with you. I want to talk next with Congressman Mark Meadows, who's the chairman of the Freedom Caucus, about the leadership race in the House, which will be inevitable. Certainly if Republicans maintain the House, it will be particularly of interest to all of us. And so, Mark, thanks for joining us and staying a little bit overtime here. I want to ask you just a real plain question. Do you really think the Republicans can keep the House, given the odds?
Well, I do think we can keep the House. It is obviously the statistics and the mathematical formulas are not in our favor, but I can tell you that the voters are. And if our voters and many of your listeners will not be complacent and will actually go to the polls between now and November 6th or on November 6th, depending on what state they live in, it is very winnable. Now, if we win the majority, I think it will be very slim. I think you can make a strong case that we're going to lose 18 to 20 seats. We can only lose 22 at 23. It becomes a Speaker Pelosi and not a Speaker on the Republican side of the aisle. And so, but if I were to handicap it today, I would give us a real shot, and by that, maybe 25% shot that we can keep the majority. That has increased because I would probably have said less than 10% only a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, Larry Schweikart, who follows the early voting and absentee ballots just for Florida alone, he says Florida combined early voting and absentees, Republicans lead by 53,168. So far, Republicans only trail Democrats in early walk-in voting, where they usually lose big, and they are trailed by 2,900 votes. And he says the Democrats must come out of combined early absentee voting ahead to win in Florida. Now, we're seeing that reflected in polls, which I could drop in different races. I think DeSantis is now looking as though he's ahead of his opponent by 1 point. That's in the governor's race. So that's Florida. My point is that the trends from what we're seeing are in favor of the Republicans, but of course you can't take it to the bank, and we know no matter what, it's very close. So the thing that may be a little hard for people to understand, not maybe my listeners, Congressman, because I talk about this so often, but from your point of view, what is at stake in now this leadership race? And by that I mean Congress members get elected, they go back, let's assume that the Republicans maintain control, however slim. Now they have to choose Speaker of the House and all the committee assignments. What is at stake from your vantage point on that election in the House?
Well, it's not just the Speaker's race, and you mentioned that very, very thoughtfully there, Sandy. I think the other big thing is who's going to direct each and every committee. And so let's take a best-case scenario. Republicans keep the majority. Who becomes Speaker, Majority Leader, who become the chairman will really define how strong we're going to be on the issues that you and I hold dear. Are we really going to fight for religious liberty? Are we really going to fight to look at right-sizing the federal role of government in our daily lives? And so, for far too long, even on with a Republican majority, it was kind of like, well, we're going to go ahead and put these chairmen in place and we're going to put the leadership in place. And a lot of times they didn't have real strong conservative credentials. And so that's at stake. But the worst case scenario is if you look at a Democrat majority, you end up with a Speaker Pelosi, and everybody can say, well, we've had a Speaker Pelosi before and you can opine on that. But it's the chairmanship. What you would have is you would have Maxine Waters, the head of financial services. You talk about banking and the economy going backwards based on her rhetoric and based on what she thinks. It would be very problematic. You would have Jerry Nadler and Elijah Cummings on judiciary and oversight. And the number of investigations that would be launched, and I'm not talking about legitimate investigations. I'm talking about, fishing expeditions that would create a political narrative. It would be very troubling, and more of that coming out of judiciary than oversight. But it still is something that is extremely troubling, and it's why all your listeners need to stay engaged. You do a good job of informing them. But you know, as you know, I'm a big fan of Jim Jordan, so I would love for him to be the Speaker of the House. He is, you know, actively working and campaigning, and but the real key is we've got to transform the way that Washington D.C. does business. It shouldn't be just a speaker or a leader or a minority leader doing all of the decision making. It should be broad, a broad spectrum of members that actually bring different expertise. And I think that that's the biggest aspect as we look at this leadership race. Are we going to do business the way that it's always been done, which is means ineffective and not efficient, or are we going to fundamentally change it? And I've even been talking to some of my Democrat colleagues to see about changing the rules and how do we actually make Washington, D.C. work for the average American taxpayer.
You know, it's my perspective, as somebody who stands by closely, but still just standing by, that the speakership of Paul Ryan has just been the most inactive, inert. The only time we hear Congressman Paul Ryan actually publicly go to bat, it's when President Trump says something that offends him. And that's when we hear his voice. Most of the time, it's just silence. And we watched under John Boehner's leadership these committee hearings that were just show ponies. I let me just mention one. This is the one probably that upset me as much as any of them, and that was the Benghazi hearing, because so many of my friends were on the front lines of that, know a ton about that. We had a whole organization, including Andy McCarthy and others, who were experts on what took place at Benghazi. And I know for a fact that under John Boehner's leadership, first of all, we had to drag him kicking and screaming to even have hearings, and then the hearing itself was so incomplete. And so much of the story never did come out. And I give that as an illustration of why the speaker's race is so important. The Freedom Caucus, under your leadership, has been willing to take on the leadership, and people need to know how dangerous a prospect that is. And you have been forthright now about Jim Jordan running for speaker. What's happening with that, Congressman? What's happening behind the scenes that you can tell us?
Well, a lot of outreach is being done. Obviously, the two leading candidates are Jim Jordan and Kevin McCarthy, the only two that have really announced for that. And, you know, odds on favorite right now are for Kevin McCarthy. And part of that is, you know, when you have a machine that's in place, you know, people typically, you know, gravitate to that power. And Kevin has a lot of that power. And listen, I want to give him his due as well. I mean, he's out campaigning as Jim and I are out campaigning. Kevin's out doing that. And so it's not a totally negative connotation there. But the other part that I would say is if you want Washington, D.C. to change, you can't change it with the same cast of players. It's not going to change because what happens is they, you know, the minute the freshmen come in, and you're talking about leadership elections, they're going to happen within a couple of weeks of the November 6th elections. They actually happen before people are sworn in, and so you have all these positions and jockeying for favors, and by the time that they're sworn in and they talk about who they're voting for speaker, you know, the actual final chapter many times has been written. It says, well, we're not going to lead. We're going to hopefully just keep our head down and hope that the American people will forget that we campaigned one way and legislated another. I think it's time that we actually fulfill the promises that we make on the campaign trail. President Trump has been doing that, you know, from moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, to delivering on tax cuts, for being the most pro-life president that we've ever had. I mean, when you look at some of these issues, he's performed on those campaign promises, whether he was your first choice or your last. He's done that in real outstanding terms. We need to do the same in Congress and put legislation on his desk that represents the will of the American people.
Could you please paint a pretty vivid picture of what would happen if Jim Jordan were speaker? What would happen? What would it look like? And connect the dots for the American people. How would that be different?
Well, it would be different in three ways. One is Jim Jordan's running not because of Jim Jordan. It's really because what he wants to do is empower the committees. You mentioned the Benghazi, so maybe the best thing is to go back to the Benghazi hearing. Here we had four Americans that lost their lives, and we had a very lengthy investigation that actually held no one accountable and really produced no real result after really, as you mentioned, having real details on what was wrong and what needed to change. We had investigations into an email server that was a private email server that went nowhere. And the American people are tired of the show, and I think you said it best. What they want is real investigations, real insight into making sure that the Washington, D.C. is held accountable, and then once it's held accountable, that it changes. And so, in a Benghazi investigation under Jim Jordan, I think he wrote a different report. He and Secretary Pompeo wrote a different report that actually highlighted some of the concerns that they had. And so as you look at this, I think the biggest thing is empower individual members of Congress. So the power is not just concentrated with two or three people at the top. It actually gets among a whole number of different members. And so people with expertise on foreign policy, surprise, surprise, they actually lead the Foreign Affairs Committee. People with expertise in banking, surprise, surprise, they actually lead what happens in the financial services industry. Right now, it's more of a pay-to-play kind of thing. The person who gives the most money and gives up their voting card gets the best position. That would all change under a Jim Jordan speakership.
Well, I think you have painted a very accurate and understandable picture of what's at stake, and you've helped me, Congressman Meadows, because I try to... It's very complex, and people are living their lives. They're living their lives. At least they're trying to pursue happiness, according, to our preamble, the pursuit of happiness. And so they don't have the time to get into this, and that's why we need them, though. This is a Paul Revere moment. This election is so crucial, and the way the results come out will have a tremendous effect on each and every life of the people listening to us right now and their children. And so that's why I'm encouraging people to get involved, to vote. House Freedom Caucus, you can check their PAC at House Freedom Fund to figure out what you might do to help. And meanwhile, always prayer, because Congressman Mark Meadows, Congressman Jim Jordan, and many of the members of the House Freedom Caucus and others who serve in the House and in the Senate are believers who are on their knees, trust me, seeking God in the decisions that they made. And we need to pray for them and intercede and ask God to protect them. So, Congressman, I appreciate so much of your time this morning in this busy, busy season. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Sandy. God bless you, and God bless America.
Yes, same, same. Back to you, sir. Thank you so much. All right, I want to give you just a few things while we go out here. Just a few updates. Mike Braun has moved ahead of Joe Donnelly by 3 points in Indiana. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has pulled to within striking distance of his Democratic opponent, Tony Evers, after the president was in Milwaukee last week. Josh Hawley has moved ahead of Claire McCaskill by 1 point in St. Louis. Beto O'Rourke, who's raised $70 million since he entered the race in 2017, is still behind Senator Ted Cruz in spite of the massive efforts on his part. John James is moving up in Michigan, and he is the conservative running against Debbie Stabenow. And there's more to say, and I'll say it. I'll try to give you as much of an update every day, really. We have 8 days before this election, and I want to arm you the very best way that I can. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.